A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been watching The Wolf of Wall Street, like most people, and got curious about what Quaaludes actually were. He assumed, reasonably, that the infamous crawling down the country club stairs scene was some kind of overdose or after effect, and that the drug itself was mostly euphoric. But the real pharmacology is weirder, and the whole history, how they came on the scene, how they slipped into non-medical use, and what got them banned, is one of the strangest cautionary tales in drug regulation.
The thing is, that scene gets the pharmacology almost exactly backwards. What you're watching isn't a typical recreational dose, it's severe ataxia and what's called paradoxical excitation. Jordan Belfort's character is essentially experiencing something closer to an overdose reaction. The drug was never supposed to make you crawl downstairs like a broken marionette.
The most famous cultural depiction of Quaaludes is actually showing you the thing that went wrong with them, not the thing people were chasing.
And that's what makes this moment worth revisiting. We're in the middle of a polysubstance overdose crisis. There's this renewed fascination with classic sedative hypnotics, and we keep seeing the same pattern. A supposedly safer alternative emerges, gets marketed as the solution to the last drug problem, and then becomes its own disaster. Tianeptine is doing exactly this right now. It's being called a safer antidepressant, a safer opioid alternative, and we're watching the same script play out in real time.
The safer trap.
The safer trap. And Quaaludes might be the single cleanest case study of how that trap works, because they genuinely were safer than barbiturates on one narrow metric, and that one fact blinded everyone to everything else that was about to happen.
Where do we even start with this?
1951. A chemist in India named M. Gujral synthesizes a new quinazolinone compound. He's trying to make an anti-malarial drug. It completely fails at treating malaria, but somebody notices it puts people to sleep. That's the origin story. A failed anti-malarial that made people drowsy. By the early 60s, it's being marketed globally under a dozen different brand names. Quaalude in the US, Mandrax in the UK and Europe, Rivonal in Germany, and so on. The pitch was straightforward. Here's a sedative, hypnotic, that doesn't carry the same overdose risk as barbiturates.
Which, to be fair, was a real selling point. Barbiturates at the time were basically the standard for sedation, and they had a terrifyingly narrow margin between the dose that put you to sleep and the dose that stopped you breathing.
Phenobarbital, secobarbital, pentobarbital, these were the workhorses, and they were dangerous. A 10 times therapeutic dose could be fatal. So when methaqualone showed up with a wider therapeutic window on that specific metric, less respiratory depression, it looked like a genuine breakthrough. Doctors prescribed it enthusiastically.
The branding didn't hurt. These names sound almost pleasant. Nothing like the clinical baritone of pentobarbital.
The American brand name Quaalude apparently came from quiet interlude, which is almost too perfect. It's the sedative equivalent of naming a sports car adrenaline. And by the late 60s, it was one of the most prescribed sedatives in the country.
Here's the central paradox. It actually was less lethal in a straightforward overdose than barbiturates. That part wasn't a lie. But it had its own unique abuse liability and a side effect profile that nobody saw coming. Or at least, nobody wanted to see.
That's the whole story in 2 sentences. The molecule had properties that made it strangely compelling as a recreational drug in ways that barbiturates never were. And the cultural moment it landed in, the early 70s, disco, the whole me decade ethos, was perfectly primed to turn it into a phenomenon.
We're looking at a 3-act tragedy. Act 1, invention and promise, the safer sedative. Act 2, cultural explosion and widespread abuse. Act 3, the ban and everything that followed.
Act 3, as we'll see, doesn't really end. It just moves to different continents.
Alright, so let's get into the molecule itself. Barbiturates first. What's actually happening at the receptor level?
Barbiturates work by binding to GABA, A receptors, and holding the chloride ion channel open longer than it normally would. GABA is your brain's main inhibitory neurotransmitter. It's the brake pedal. Barbiturates basically jam the brake pedal to the floor. At low doses, sedation. At higher doses, anesthesia. At about 10 times the sedative dose, the respiratory centers in the brainstem just stop firing. You stop breathing. That's the narrow therapeutic index everyone was terrified of.
Methacrolone hits the same receptor, but differently.
It's also a positive allosteric modulator at GABA, A, but it binds at a distinct site from barbiturates. It's not just a weaker barbiturate, it's a different key in a different lock on the same door. And that distinction matters because it also has significant activity at histamine and acetylcholine receptors, antihistaminergic and anticholinergic effects. That's where the subjective experience gets weird.
The floaty sensation.
The antihistamine component adds a kind of drowsy, heavy-limbed quality. Think Benadryl, but stronger. And the anticholinergic effects contribute to that dreamy, disconnected feeling. Users describe it as being wrapped in warm cotton while the world happens somewhere else. Barbiturates just knock you out. Methacrolone makes you feel like you're dissolving.
Which is precisely why it became recreational.
Precisely why the SAFER claim was so misleading. The animal studies. There was a key one in 1973 by Gerald and Compagnie comparing methacrolone and pentobarbital in rats. Showed methacrolone had a wider margin between the effective dose and the lethal dose when you measured respiratory depression. Higher LD50 relative to ED50. On that one metric, it looked safer.
That metric ignored everything else.
It ignored the steepness of the dose response curve for other effects. Methacrolone produced loss of riding reflex, the point where the animal can't flip itself upright, with a much steeper curve than pentobarbital, meaning a small increase in dose could push you from pleasantly sedated to unable to stand very quickly, and it ignored the paradoxical excitation entirely.
Explain that term.
Instead of sedation, some users get agitation, confusion, aggressive behavior, severe ataxia, the stumbling, uncoordinated movement, while still being profoundly impaired cognitively. They look awake, they might even be talking, but they have no idea what's happening. That's the looted-out state. It's not euphoria, it's a kind of waking blackout with motor dysfunction.
Which is exactly what The Wolf of Wall Street depicts.
That crawling scene is textbook severe ataxia with paradoxical excitation. Belfort's character is conscious enough to narrate what's happening to him, but his motor control is completely gone. That's not the recreational sweet spot. That's what happens when you overshoot it, which was extremely easy to do because the margin was so narrow.
The pharmacokinetics made overshooting practically inevitable.
This is where it gets dangerous. Methacrolone is absorbed rapidly after oral ingestion. Peak plasma concentration hits at about 2 hours. But the half-life is 20 to 40 hours. That's extraordinarily long for a sedative hypnotic. If you're taking it recreationally, say 2 nights in a row, you're stacking doses on top of residual drug from the previous night.
The Tuesday dose is adding to Monday's leftovers.
Which are still very much active. And that accumulation leads to a withdrawal syndrome that's comparable to barbiturate withdrawal. Delirium, seizures, potentially fatal if untreated. There were case reports of withdrawal seizures lasting up to 10 days. People thought they were taking a party drug with no consequences because it wasn't killing them on the spot, and meanwhile the drug was building up in their systems in ways they didn't understand.
The genetic variability piece.
Methacrolone is metabolized primarily by two liver enzymes, CYP2C9 and CYP3A4. Both of these have significant genetic polymorphisms. Some people are slow metabolizers. The drug hangs around even longer, accumulation is worse, effects are stronger. Others are fast metabolizers. They clear it quickly and might take more to compensate, which creates its own risks. Two people take the same dose at the same party and have wildly different experiences. One is mildly sedated, the other can't walk.
Which sounds like a recipe for exactly the kind of unpredictable disaster we saw.
Then you add alcohol. Alcohol doesn't just add to methacrolone's effects, it potentiates them synergistically. They compete for the same metabolic pathways, so alcohol slows methacrolone clearance, and methacrolone enhances alcohol's sedative effects. The combination produces impairment far beyond what either substance would cause alone.
The Mandrax cocktail.
That was the infamous UK combination, methacrolone, alcohol, and an antihistamine-like diphenhydramine. It became wildly popular in British nightclubs in the early 70s. Emergency rooms saw a huge spike in admissions, people arriving profoundly sedated, barely breathing, but also sometimes combative and confused from the paradoxical excitation. It was a nightmare to manage clinically because you had simultaneous sedation and agitation.
The supposedly safer sedative had created a uniquely dangerous recreational combination that barbiturates never really inspired.
Barbiturates don't feel good, they just put you to sleep. Nobody was mixing pentobarbital with beer and calling it a party. Methaqualone had this peculiar hedonic profile, the floaty warmth, the disinhibition, that made people want to push the dose and combine it with other things. The safety advantage on paper was completely erased by the way humans actually used it.
That's the pharmacology. A drug with a wider safety margin on one narrow metric, but a hedonic profile and metabolic unpredictability that made it far more dangerous in practice than on paper. And that brings us to the moment everything exploded.
The early 70s. Disco is taking over, Studio 54 is about to open its doors, and America is deep in what Tom Wolfe called the Me Decade. An era of sexual liberation, recreational hedonism, and a cultural appetite for altered states that felt safer than the previous generation's heroin and barbiturate nightmares. Quaaludes were the perfect drug for that exact moment. Disco Biscuits, 700 Fords, that was the imprint on the Lemon Pharmaceuticals pill, and it became street shorthand. Lemon's Quaalude 704 was the most recognized and counterfeited version. The branding was so strong that 714 became synonymous with the drug itself.
The musical equivalent of beige wallpaper, but for pharmaceuticals. A pill so iconic its serial number became its name.
The numbers tell the story. By 1972, methaqualone was the sixth most prescribed sedative in the United States. But that's only the legal side. The DEA, which had just been created, estimated that by 1973, 20 million tablets were being diverted or illegally manufactured every single year.
20 million tablets annually. In a country of about 210 million people at the time, that's one illicit dose for every 10 Americans every year.
That's a conservative estimate. Time magazine ran a cover story in 1972 titled, "The Pill That Makes You Feel Good and Bad." And the article framed methaqualone as a Jekyll and Hyde substance. One dose, you're warm and floaty. The next, you're a stumbling, incoherent mess. The media narrative had already turned.
The regulatory response starts in 1973, Schedule 2.
And this is where the regulatory arc gets interesting. The DEA wanted to place methaqualone in Schedule 2 of the Controlled Substances Act, which meant it was recognized as having high abuse potential but also accepted medical use, so it could still be prescribed, just with tight controls. But the pharmaceutical companies pushed back hard. Roar, which owned Quaalude at the time, and Lemon, which later acquired it, argued vigorously that methaqualone had legitimate medical value and that scheduling would deprive patients of a useful drug.
Which, in fairness, it did have medical value. It was an effective sedative. Hypnotic.
And that's the tension at the heart of drug scheduling. You're balancing genuine therapeutic utility against abuse liability, and the evidence for abuse was mounting fast. The 1973 scheduling was a compromise. It restricted prescribing, but didn't stop production. The drug stayed on the market, just with more paperwork.
Which didn't solve the problem.
It barely dented it. Illicit manufacturing was already so widespread that restricting the legal supply just pushed more users toward the black market. And the black market pills were often adulterated, mixed with other depressants, inconsistent in dose. The scheduling made the drug more dangerous, not less, because it eliminated quality control without eliminating demand.
How did we get from Schedule 2 to the full ban?
1984. The DEA held administrative hearings on reclassifying methaqualone to Schedule 1, which means no accepted medical use and a complete ban on manufacture and prescription. The testimony was devastating. Addiction specialists described withdrawal syndromes with seizures lasting up to 10 days. Emergency room data showed a steady climb in methaqualone-related admissions throughout the late 70s and early 80s, even after the Schedule 2 restrictions. And politically, the Reagan administration's war on drugs was in full swing. There was enormous pressure to take a hard line.
The ban was as much political theater as public health.
The two were impossible to separate. The DEA's own analysis showed that moving to Schedule 1 would reduce availability, but the question was always, reduce it for whom? Legal patients lost access to a medication that some of them benefited from. Recreational users, the actual target, just shifted to whatever was available on the black market.
What happened after the ban?
Production moved underground. Clandestine labs popped up primarily in South Africa and India, where precursor chemicals were less regulated and enforcement was weaker. By the 90s, methaqualone had largely vanished from the American drug supply, replaced first by benzodiazepines like Valium and Xanax, which were safer in overdose, and then by the opioid epidemic, which made the whole Quaalude era look almost quaint by comparison.
20 million diverted tablets a year, and it's the quaint drug crisis.
That's what the opioid epidemic did to our sense of scale. But here's the thing, methaqualone didn't disappear globally. In South Africa, Mandrax is still a major drug of abuse. They smoke it with marijuana. It's called white pipe. And it's been a persistent public health crisis there for decades, long after the US moved on.
The ban worked, in the narrowest sense. It got Quaaludes out of American medicine cabinets. But it didn't end methaqualone. It just exported the problem.
That brings us back to the Wolf of Wall Street. Belfort's memoir describes heavy Quaalude use in the 1980s, but by then, methaqualone was already Schedule I. He wasn't getting these from a pharmacy. He was buying them on a black market that the ban had created. The film's most famous scene, the crawling, the drooling, the complete loss of motor control, that's not what most users were chasing. That's what happened when the dose went wrong. And the dose went wrong constantly, because black market pills had no consistency, and because the drug's own pharmacology made the margin between pleasure and disaster vanishingly thin.
What does this whole strange history actually teach us? Because it'd be easy to just file it under weird 70s thing and move on.
The pattern keeps recurring. The safer alternative narrative, methaqualone, was to barbiturates exactly what OxyContin was to morphine, what synthetic cannabinoids were to THC. Each time, the safety claim rests on one narrow metric. For Quaaludes, it was the LD50 and respiratory depression. For OxyContin, it was the controlled release mechanism that was supposed to make abuse harder. For synthetics, it was natural cannabis without the paranoia.
In every case, the metric was true, but irrelevant, once the drug hit the real world.
Because the metric ignored polydrug use, ignored accumulation, ignored withdrawal, and ignored the fact that humans don't take drugs in laboratory conditions. They take them with alcohol, they redose, they share pills of unknown provenance. The safety advantage evaporates the moment the drug leaves the clinical trial and enters a nightclub.
Which brings us to the scheduling problem. Schedule 2 from 73 to 84, a full decade where the drug was restricted but still legal, and abuse didn't stop. It just moved.
In some ways got worse. Schedule 2 meant the legal supply had quality control but was harder to get. The black market had no quality control but was easy to get. So you push users toward inconsistent, adulterated pills while eliminating medical oversight. The scheduling was supposed to be a middle ground, and it ended up being the worst of both worlds.
Then Schedule I in 84, the full ban, which did reduce American use, but at the cost of criminalizing everyone involved, and exporting the problem to countries with weaker regulatory systems.
South Africa is still dealing with Mandrax today, 40 years later. We banned it and forgot about it. They didn't get to forget.
Drug scheduling is a blunt instrument that sometimes works in one country and creates a crisis in another. That's not an argument against regulation. It's an argument for being honest about what regulation actually accomplishes and what it just displaces.
The third lesson is the one I think gets overlooked most. Cultural context isn't background noise. It's the active ingredient. Quaaludes weren't just a molecule. They were a response to a specific social moment. Disco, sexual liberation, the search for a high that felt safer than what the previous generation was doing. The drug fit the moment like a key in a lock.
Which means if you want to predict how a new drug will evolve, tianeptine, xylazine, whatever comes next, you can't just study the pharmacology. You have to understand what cultural need it's filling.
Tianeptine is the perfect current example. It's being marketed as a safer antidepressant, a safer opioid alternative, available at gas stations and online. The pharmacology says one thing. The cultural moment, a population burned by the opioid crisis, desperate for something that doesn't kill them, distrustful of the medical establishment, says something else entirely, and we're watching the same pattern unfold.
The molecule proposes, but the culture disposes.
And if we keep evaluating drugs solely on narrow pharmacological metrics, while ignoring the social context they're landing in, we're going to keep being surprised when the safer alternative becomes the next disaster.
Here's the question I keep coming back to. Could a drug like methacholone ever be reintroduced medically? Not as a recreational throwback, but as a legitimate therapeutic with modern safeguards.
I've thought about this a lot, and I'm torn. On one hand, we now have tools that didn't exist in the 70s. Abuse deterrent formulations, prescription monitoring programs, genetic screening for those CYP450 variants. You could theoretically identify slow metabolizers in advance, control the dose precisely, and track every prescription.
The technical answer is yes, we could do it safely. The real question is whether the risk profile is inherent to the molecule or was a product of its moment.
I think the answer is both. The steep dose response curve and the paradoxical excitation are baked into the pharmacology. No amount of monitoring changes the fact that a small dosing error produces catastrophic impairment. That's not a cultural problem, that's a molecular one.
It's also true that benzodiazepines essentially filled the medical niche methacholone occupied, and they did it more safely. There's no clinical gap that Quaaludes would fill today.
Which makes the question academic, but not irrelevant. Because we're seeing a resurgence of interest in psychedelics and classic drugs for therapy, MDMA, psilocybin, ketamine, and the Quaalude story is a reminder that the line between medicine and menace is often thinner than we think.
The cultural moment matters as much as the molecule. That's the thing I keep landing on.
It's the entire lesson. MDMA-assisted therapy works in a controlled clinical setting with trained therapists. The same molecule at a rave is a completely different thing. The drug didn't change. The context did.
Methacholone in a doctor's office in 1965 was a different drug than methacholone at Studio 54 in 1975. Same pills, different universe.
The open question isn't really about Quaalude specifically. It's about whether we've gotten any better at understanding that molecule-context interaction, or whether we're just running the same experiment again with different compounds and hoping for a different result.
With tianeptine sitting on gas station counters right now, I'm not sure we have.
And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1860s, Himalayan explorers documented that certain ice caves in Nepal's Khumbu region produce sustained resonant frequencies when wind passes through their chambers, essentially natural pipe organs carved by glacial melt, with some tunnels humming at a steady C-sharp for hours at a time.
A glacier playing C-sharp for hours? That's either the most majestic thing I've ever heard or the most annoying.
Depends whether you're trying to sleep near it, I imagine.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps. We're back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.